Now, last Friday, we were hoping to have the feminist author Naomi Wolf as one of our panellists on our show from the International Literary Festival Dublin. Well, as those of you who are listening may know, unfortunately, Naomi Wolf missed her flight, and so we had to go ahead with a different version of that programme. In the meantime, her book, Outrageous: Sex, Censorship and the Criminalisation of Love, has come in for a lot of criticism, the scholarship involved being questioned. The book looks at the life of the poet and essayist John Addington Symonds, a homosexual man who lived at a turning point in Victorian England when the forces of the state began to introduce draconian sentences against homosexuality, including deportation and sentences of death. Last week on BBC Three's Arts and Ideas programme, Matthew Sweet questioned whether, as Wolfe states in Outrageous, some men were executed. This is the exchange between the two.
Who was executed?
I found like several dozen executions, but that was again only looking at the Old Bailey records and the crime tables.
Dozen executions?
Correct. And this corrects a misapprehension that is in every website, that the last man was executed for sodomy in Britain in 1835.
I don't think you're right about this. One of the cases that you look at that's salient in your report is that of Thomas Silver. It says, teenagers were now convicted more often. Indeed, that year, which is 1859, 14-year-old Thomas Silver was actually executed for committing sodomy. The boy was indicted for an unnatural offence. Guilty, death recorded. This is the first time the phrase unnatural offence entered the Old Bailey records. Thomas Silver wasn't executed. Death recorded. I was really surprised by this, and I looked it up. Death recorded is what's in, I think, most of these cases that you've identified as executions. It doesn't mean that he was executed. It was a category that was created in 1823 that allowed judges to abstain from pronouncing a sentence of death on any capital convict whom they considered to be a fit subject for pardon. I don't think any of the executions you've identified here actually happened.
Well, that's a really important thing to investigate.
Naomi Wolf there speaking to Matthew Sweet on BBC Three's Arts and Ideas programme last week. She has since agreed, has Naomi Wolf, that this was an error of understanding of the phrase death recorded, and she has said that she will amend further copies of the book, and also she is looking into whether some of the homosexual acts recounted in Outrageous were in fact consensual or were they rapes, because that is another question that has been brought up. Yvonne Nolan has been reading Outrageous for us, and she's with me in studio. Now, we'll come back to the specifics of, I mean, it is when you hear the silence, as Matthew Sweet puts forward the big fly in the ointment, it is amazing radio just to listen to that, Yvonne. But before we get into what exactly that controversy is about, tell me a little bit about the man this book started out being about, I think, John Addington Symonds, and what kind of figure was he in Victorian Britain?
So John Addington Symonds wasn't, a very famous figure in Victorian literary circles, but he was well connected and he knew everybody. He wrote some very bad poetry. I think even by the yardstick of, you know, Victorian florid verse, John Addington Symonds' poetry was pretty bad. However, he was a wonderful writer about Greek ethics, about Greek culture, about Italian culture, about art. He was a really smart man. Mm. And you wouldn't know that, particularly from reading his quite constipated poetry.
And the other thing, I think, wasn't he one of the first, certainly, to put forward the idea of, certainly at this time, that homosexual acts were natural? Because there was always the idea was put across that they were an abomination of some kind. He was, from the outset, almost saying, no, these are natural acts.
He was, but he was saying it secretly amongst his group of friends. So the story of Symonds's life is one of repression. He had tuberculosis right through his life, and really towards the end of his life, when he knew his time was coming to a close, then he committed a lot to record in memoirs, right. And he cooperated with Havelock Ellis's book called Inversion, which was about, it was the first work of sexology of that period.
All right, let's come to Naomi Wolf's book then, Outrageous Sex, Censorship and the Criminalization of Love. What is the central thesis? Simmons is important to it, but what's the central thesis of the book?
In the historical or the historical sociological argument of the book is that before the Victorian times, yes, sodomy was a crime on the statute books from 1533 and Henry VIII onwards, it was a crime. The Bible, of course, you know, called it an abomination. Always, this was an area of sexual practice that was, you know, not allowed, not in the mainstream. Her thesis is that even though all those things pertained, there was a reasonable degree of permissiveness about what people did in private. She says in the Victorian age, the state got into the bedroom, and worse than getting into the bedroom, it actually got into people's lives. You know, later on, she documents legislation that could convict you on the basis of association. So that if you met another man and both of you were suspected of being homosexual, even if you met for a coffee,
that was sufficient that for a conviction.
That could be seen as conspiring to commit an indecent act.
And the potential sentences here were very serious.
The potential sentences were severe. They were 2 years hard labour. In general, they could be longer, but in the centrality of cases, it was 2 years hard labour. And now, say for instance, later on, when Oscar Wilde is convicted and is sent to Reading Jail, it broke him. I mean, the physical hardship of those 2 years, you know, pretty much, I would say, shortened his life in the end.
And when did sodomy, was it always a capital offence from back in Henry VIII, as you said?
But the problem with sodomy from the judicial point of view is that because it happened in private, it was hard to prove, and it was often one person's word against another's.
Now, let's get to this phrase, death recorded, because at one level, this sounds as if it's a technicality. And while you might expect a scholarly book certainly to find out what the technicality actually means, it might, on the surface, read as nothing more than a small misinterpretation of an important legal phrase.
Well, I would say, you know, relying on the Old Bailey records, which are online, as your source for research. So doing an it's almost next door to looking up Wikipedia. to use that as your sole source for a very important part of your book is not enough. And it's not just poor scholarship. Even in my own context of my background in work, it's poor journalism. I mean, fact-checking at least two sources when you're going to make a claim that is unusual. So, for instance, we know from her interview that she knew that everyone believes that the last execution for sodomy was in 1835. So she gotta wonder how come nobody else in the whole world had discovered that a whole raft of executions then happened later on.
So she simply took the phrase death recorded to mean executed.
She took the phrase death recorded to mean executed. And if she had looked further, say for instance in that case that was mentioned of Thomas Silver, when you look at the newspaper version of that, contrary to the erroneous Old Bailey record, Thomas Silver was 17 years old at the time, and he'd committed an assault on a six-year-old boy.
Yeah, so this is not sodomy this is not an act between consenting adults.
This is not consenting adults. And what's more, you know, by our own standards even, or by Victorian standards, assault on a child is a serious matter. And the kind of cases that are used in reference where it's a case of sexual exploitation or sexual assault, they're not what you want to see in a book that says it's about Victorian repression of consensual gay love.
And how vital is, you know, she goes on to give us the detail on those, not the detail on the execution, but the detail of some of the men involved in the various convictions. How central is that aspect of that these men were executed? How central is that to the thesis of the book?
I wouldn't say it's the only thing, and I wouldn't say like these two mistakes are horrendous mistakes that no scholar would want in their book. However, I mean, her thesis is not based on execution alone, but there was a mistake in hyping the execution end to the exclusion of all else. So she looks at the rise in censorship, how pornography began to flood in from France, the London porn industry was thriving, and that, you know, all kinds of publications opened up that hadn't been there before. Now, what the Victorians weren't, I think also this book takes a standpoint that, hey guys, we all know the Victorians were the most prudish humans that ever lived. It's just not true. The Victorians were addicted to improvement, if anything. So, bullheadedly sometimes, but what they wanted to do was make a better society. Industrialization, the railways, everything was showing that humans could do something more, be something better. And they applied that to matters of morality as well as everything else.
What about there is another aspect to the argument in Naomi Wolf's book, I think, which is this idea that, in the mid-1850s, in the middle of the 19th century, there was essentially a big shift in attitudes to homosexuality. A lot of it fear on the part of heterosexual men, a fear that you mentioned prostitution, you mentioned several other things there, fear about what was happening in society. Do you think that holds water, and does she argue that well?
Well, part of another argument she makes is that when the woman question became important in the mid-19th century, some very bright, vociferous women were pressing for more equal divorce for women. So before that, you had to go through an ecclesiastical court, and it was interminable, and it ill-favoured women. So there began to be pressure for women to have more access to divorce, and that it couldn't just be initiated by a man. But Wolf makes the argument that because heterosexual men, the judiciary and the parliamentarians, still want to shield their privileges to be adulterous, they put in a whole lot of categories into what basis a woman could sue for divorce, and one of them was sodomy. Another one was rape, but not of the woman herself. If her husband raped another woman, that could be an instance as well.
I suppose important to this part of the story as well is the fact that we're talking about a very specific era in terms of public schools in Britain, and sexual acts between young boys, maybe, and older boys, and in some cases teachers and younger boys.
Yeah, another historian of this period, a real historian of this period has said that pederasty, the relationship between an older boy and a younger boy, or an older man and a younger man, was the single most influential shaping of homoerotic desire in English society. And for upper class men, they all went to public school, they were all exposed to this. Like, even Simmons, and she doesn't quote this, Simmons says in his memoir, at Harrow, every boy of good looks was given a female name, was either recognised as a public prostitute or some bigger fellow's bitch.
Now, that's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And
she doesn't quote that in the book. I mean, that's a great quote. Mm. I mean, the thing about it is that she seems tin-eared when it comes to the wonder of Simmons' good writing, his memoirs.
One thing that did strike me, because there was vitriol pouring out on Twitter, as it often does, about many things. But in the case of Naomi Wolf, I mean, she has been the subject of lots of controversy in the past. She seems, I don't know that if courting is not a fair term, but she seems to certainly, controversy is thrust upon her right from the very start.
Yes, I mean, right from the very start, her first book in the early 90s, The Beauty Myth, which the thesis of that was that as women became more liberated, the pressure to look good increased, so that they got rid of one form of enslavement only to be involved in another form of enslavement. One of the things was, of course, body image and body shape. And she cited a statistic that said 150,000 women died in the US every
year.
Again,
we're talking about death, ironically enough.
From anorexia-related illnesses. And that turns out to be 150,000 women in the US at that time were experiencing eating disorders, not dying. for deaths, you're talking about maybe 60 or 70 a year at the time. So there was that back then, and then she did a book about the other thing that people accuse her of is being very self-centred in how she views the world. So she wrote a book about birth when she had a child. She wrote a book about the vagina when she got to thinking more about that. But there's a kind of a Pollyanna-ish earnestness to how she goes about things.
Fine.
And just because an argument seems intuitive doesn't mean it's right. That's kind of the core thing. Just because it seems intuitive doesn't mean
it's good
history.
You have to prove it. And certainly in a scholarly text, you have to prove it. What would you say about Naomi Wolf's outrages? Should we read? Is it worth reading for any parts of it? Or is it just going to get lost in this controversy now?
No, I think it's a really readable book. And I'm not sorry I read it. I'm very sure that there are much better and much more interesting historical works about homosexuality in the 19th century than this. But she does have a way of writing. Even though she liked John Addington Symonds so much as to lose all sense of objectivity when she was writing about him. I felt that too.
All right. So that's Yvonne Nolan speaking to us about Naomi Wolf and her book Outrageous Sex, Censorship and the Criminalization of Love, and I'm sure there will be more said about that in the coming days and weeks as well.